But okay, this intro goes for a little bit, so just buckle up.
Fuck it, I'll just sip of water.
Big deep breath.
All right, we good? Are we good? We're good?
We're good.
All right, well, it's a very, very proud day at TGC Towers. And these are our towers.
Are they?
Yeah, no, not really. It's my uncle's house. It's no stretch to say, he goes, that the man sitting in front of us here has been subject to what has to be the most comprehensive pursuit of an interview.
Yeah.
For the history, or in the history of Australian sports / cricket podcasting, 2016 to 2021 inclusive, and that's a big industry. So deeply have we wanted to sit down with this guy and express our love. We've issued invitations via his website, his BBL team, the ACA, the president of his grade cricket club, his opening partner at said grade cricket club who claimed to ask him in between overs, and his friends, just mates. And I think that's, like, it was the latter who got it over the line, and I think that's apt because in the small few years we've been doing this show, we've learnt a few things, and one of them is that this guy commands universal respect among his peers. And not just peers who played with him at the same time generationally, across different generations as well. It's not just respect, it's love. And I'd say it's on par with Ricky Ponting from what we've seen. he's too much.
Yeah.
But we want to keep it classic, so now I'm going to furnish him with some numbers. Because that's what we do. Cricketers are not personalities, they're just numbers.
That's right, yeah.
Right, yeah. And talking.
Talking numbers.
59 tests, nearly 4,000 runs at 35, 4 tons, 24 50s, high score of 176, 75 wickets at 33, 3 fifers, a best of 6 for 33, 45 catches. That's just tests. 190 ODIs, nearly 6,000 runs at 40, strike rate of 90, 9 tons, 33 50s, a high score of 185, not out, 168 poles, best of 4 for 36, 64 catches. 58 T20Is, nearly 1,500 runs there at 30, 1 ton, 10 50s, high score of 124, not out, 50 odd wickets at 24, best of 4 for 15, 20 catches. Nearly 10,000 first class runs at 43, 20 hundreds, 54 50s, high score of 203, not out, 210 wickets at a tick under 30, 7 fifers and a 10 for 109 catches. 2 World Cups, a 5-0 Ashes series, IPL wins, BBL wins, 44th Test Captain of Australia. I mean, are people aroused yet? Are we aroused?
Didn't even take a breath there. That's impressive.
I felt like I was rapping that. Yeah. You know, we're talking to a player who commenced his professional career at the Gabba, you know, around Stuart Law and Jimmy Marr, and ended it with Chris Green at Homebush. That's a span. He was a modern-day chest pipes and salad king.
Yeah.
Now does yoga every day. At one point, he bowled high 140s. Ended up scoring 4 tons for his country, many of which were opening the batting. A lot of runs opening the batting. He fielded first slip, captain the test team. He was everything to some. To some, it wasn't enough. But it was more than enough to many of us. He's now started a business called T20 Stars. I'm sure he's throwing everything into that like he did his career. It's going to revolutionise cricket kit as well. So this isn't just a warm welcome. It's a hot welcome, finally, from our hearts. Welcome to the great cricketer, Shane Watson.
Gosh, it's an amazing introduction. Thank you. It's great to be here. Obviously, you guys have been doing so much incredible things and built such a groundswell of the cricket community around Australia with what you've been doing. So it's my pleasure to finally be here.
That's actually all the time we got for today. after Pez's intro, wrap this up. I'm going to move the car.
There's going to be a few things we need to get off our chest. I guess let's just start at the beginning. What's Stuart Law like as a bloke? No, I'm kidding. We'll get to that. Mate, classic start. Let's go to the roots. What's your relationship to grade cricket?
Grade cricket? Oh, gosh, it's everything. It's been, and for me, it's been a great full circle as well. To you know, being for me the way moving out of Ipswich, because you know, to be able to play up the levels and to play for cricket for Queensland, you had to move into Brisbane to be able to play great cricket there. So my first club, East Redlands, I moved there as a 15-year-old, which my dad used to drive me nearly an hour each way to club training, a couple of times a week. And it gave me the most incredible grounding as a 15-year-old going into a great club with elder statesmen around at that time. And then to sort of, I suppose, just continue to, like, more so through, you know, when I started playing international cricket, didn't really get much. I wasn't able to stay connected to grade cricket just because I wasn't really around. The only time I played grade cricket was when I was coming back from one of my injuries. So it was more so just a quick sort of touch point to try and get back to the top again. But then the full circle had been just after I retired from international cricket to be playing just the T20 leagues and play grade cricket to keep my skills going. And that for me was a full circle because I started playing grade cricket because I loved the game. I had the dream of playing cricket for Australia, but that's all it was a dream. And it was trying to be the best cricketer I could be, whatever that was. Mm. Whether it's being a great grade cricketer, obviously my dream was to play for Australia, but then to be able to come full circle and be playing grade cricket at the back end of my career after having a long sort of professional career and going to back to people giving up their weekends to play the game they love so much. They could be doing so many other things. Mm. They could be going to the beach with their family. They could be going to the beach. They could be going out the nights before. They yes. could be working. Like, there's so many things they could be doing.
That's right.
But they're giving up. They're giving up their weekends and training during the week to be able to do what they love. So that's what I found was a great way to sort of finish off my career as well, by playing grade cricket. That realization of the beauty of the game.
We often get some anonymous intelligence on interviewees. And you're no different. So a text came in from someone who has played with you, and you've obviously played across a few eras and whatever, so you won't know who this is. mate, honestly, while he was playing for us, he would train twice a week, nearly every week, and this is the back end of your career, which is a hell of a drive from Bronte or whatever legendary place he lives in. and would stay until the end every time and often pick up cones / equipment of drills he wasn't even part of. Apart from that, genuinely one of the nicest people I've met, let alone a returning rock star. I'm forever giving of his time and advice. Honestly, go right out of his way to help you, occasionally without even being asked for help. Now, you're sitting across, Watto, from a couple of guys with sort of 20 years of collective grade cricket experience between us. So we've had a few state and international players come back, and frankly, we don't trust this account. Because that's not the behaviour we've seen from returning state and international players. So, like, forgive the cynicism. So, what's doing with this? So, I'm just sort of not really sure the question, but
yeah, so what are the secrets?
What are we looking at?
Look, for me, I've always been this way: is to give back to the game. It's as simple as that. Like, whether it's grade cricket, whether it's in different teams that I played with, I feel like I was so lucky to come along at a time where the great players and the senior players in the teams that I played with gave me so much time and so much advice and stood around and stayed after training to be able to help me out. So that's part I see is my journey to be able to do that to anyone I have an opportunity to be able to influence in some way. And grade cricket with the Sharks was a great opportunity to be able to do that. There was win-wins. One is a win I felt to be able to give back to Sutherland because they supported me for the back end of my career, but also from my selfish point of view, I was getting so much out of it. It gave me the discipline that I needed still with one foot in the playing camp, still playing T20 tournaments, but one foot in the other camp of life after cricket. Mm-hmm. I needed that discipline to go to training twice a week to be able to just continue to keep my skills going and then playing grade cricket on the weekend as well. Mm-hmm. It was just, from my selfish point of view, I got so much out of it. I feel I got much more out of it than what the guys did that I played with because it was just such a huge benefit for me. But it was always there to be able to help out whoever I possibly could, like everyone did for me when I was coming through. Mm.
There's a photo of when you were playing for Redlands, or you were with Redlands anyway. Mm. Now you might know the photo, and people are scoring and just watching the game, and then you're in the background in full Australian training kit. Do you know? Have you seen this photo?
No. have you got it there?
I can easily find it, I'm sure. But obviously you've come back to Redlands in full Australian kit. I just want to know how that came about. You just sort of letting people know that the big dog's here?
Yeah, that was probably back in the good old days when probably my head was a little bit too big then. that wouldn't happen nowadays, no.
But you also played in the grade game when Smith and Warner were banned. It was at Coogee Oval. Mm. Pez and I were talking about some of the names. Daniel Sams might have been playing that game as well. Sanger would have been playing. Hell of a grade lineup.
Quite slightly lower profile than the other three, but yeah.
But you scored runs that day, didn't you?
Yeah, I hit him all right.
Yes, now we're talking. This is not just a love-in because it's the same person writes in and says, like, you can't have played that much grade cricket because there's a scenario where you're playing in a two-day match and after day one, you say something to the team like, next week we should play in the middle of the square so they don't take advantage of the short boundary like we did. And this guy says, I remember everyone went silent. Now, Captain Kine just looked at him and said, how many games of cricket have you played, mate? You've got to use the same deck every week. And then you were actually...
That is a true jacket story.
Which we'll put up on.
Oh, yeah, that jacket. I got that jacket all the time. Blue jacket. And fair enough. It was, well, not jacket, it's a blue suit.
Yeah.
That was really tight. Those pants were super tight. Yeah.
That's you.
Yeah. And you know that hat?
Yeah,
and the hat. I haven't told those guys.
Yeah.
I lost that hat.
Ooh, okay, well, yeah, that's an alpha, I guess.
No, I got it mixed up with my son. Yeah. My son had one of those hats as well, and I got it mixed up, and I lost it. So I didn't reveal it, because I didn't want that blue
He's
suit again.
He's walking around a book parade with a Sutherland Dick of the Day hat on.
So I didn't, I didn't want to wear that blue suit again.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, fair enough. Yeah. But that's how naive I was.
Well, you probably didn't spend much time playing grade cricket growing up, because you sort of got into the system, I suppose, relatively quickly. And I know you're in the academy, and Mitchell Johnson actually wrote in his book some fond memories of the sort of origins of your friendship, the long-lasting friendship you two had. And he said that you put his head down a toilet during a wrestle at the academy. I mean, was that a tribute to Bradman's wrestling capabilities?
Because of Bradman's wrestling. Yeah. That's
impressive. I'm not sure we'd wrestle like that.
Yeah.
Gosh. That's the thing. So I remember hearing that I did that. There is no way that Mitch Johnson would allow me to stick his head down the toilet. He's much stronger than me.
Well,
and I wouldn't do that. I would not... anyway, so maybe my memory is not great. But we definitely had some wrestles. And it was in around, like, Neighbours in between. Like, this is how young and that we were, really, at that time. Is in between the ads of Neighbours, so we'd have a bit of a... like, we'd all... like, all the academy guys have a wrestle.
Yeah. In between the ads of Neighbours.
In between ads of Neighbours, right?
Wait till the ad. Yeah. Wait till the ad. Go to the ad. And then
it'd be on. And I remember that... Wait
till the ad. Dr. Kennedy's on.
Yeah.
It's back. Stop.
That's it. The things you do when you're younger.
Whatever flicks your switch.
Yeah, that's right. So I remember that one time where it got the wrestle got a bit heated.
Yeah.
But sticking his head down the toilet. Gosh, he would never let me do that, let alone me doing that anyway. Yeah. Wow. But that must have been, it was his recollection, so we'll have to go with that.
Yeah, okay. under 19's World Cup. I'm often interested in the under-19s World Cup because there's so many great guys just knocking about. I know you played against Yuvraj Singh in that year. Then a year later, he's playing in the Champions Trophy in the men's thing, and he knocked out Australia, right?
Yep.
Who was in your 19s World Cup side?
So Mitch Johnson, Michael Clarke was captain for a few of the games, but then he went back and played first-class cricket.
Okay.
Nathan Horitz, Andrew McDonald was there.
Cowan.
Eddie Cowan was my roommate.
Good team.
We had very good team. Gosh, there'd be a few more as well. Chris Hartley was the keeper who played, was a great keeper for Queensland. Mm. We had a very good team. Like, for those guys, that sort of generation who went through, a few of us kicked on and played for Australia, but also played a lot of first class cricket as well. So it was a really cool time.
You would have seen Adam Burnett's piece for Cricket Australia, because you go on to Queensland after that, about you versus Stuart Law. Now, I know you didn't offer comment for it. As a grade cricketer, my eyes are absolutely coming out of my sockets reading that. I speak for all grade cricketers, just because the detail of the story really captured what we also the mythology of, like, really vicious cricket from the 90s. Mm. And you talk, it's just a perfect narrative. Adam's a really good writer. Yep. Did it well from an entertainment perspective, and I'm sure it was accurate. Because you're the young buck coming through, the modern day cricketer, and you're playing against the old hard heads, right? And so I guess my question is, did you read the piece? Your eyes say that you did. What did you make of it? And in retrospect, do you now agree with Stuart Law that you can compensate for any bad behaviour by simply offering a beer after play?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. That article that Adam wrote was really well done. The research that he did, talking to a lot of different people who sort of played in around that game, that would have taken a lot of time to put together. And yeah, it was a nice piece. Yeah. That was a really, I look back on it with really fond memories, even though at the time it was a baptism of fire. It was something that hadn't really been done before. No young Queenslander had left the Queensland sort of fraternity to sort of move to another state. It just wasn't done, because it was like you had to pay your dues, you had to bide your time, and if you got an opportunity when you're 23, 24 to get into the Bulls squad and the team, then, that's what everyone had to do. Whereas you know, I was in and around there. I'd been to the cricket academy with guys, with those guys that I sort of talked about, a majority of those guys who didn't have an opportunity to be able to play first class cricket at that time. And that was my opportunity to be able to sort of take that next step up the ladder. Mm. So for me, it was a no brainer to move down to Tassie to be able to play those games. But yeah, then Queensland, especially like Stuart Law and Jimmy Maher, it's old school way of doing things, which is, it's how it was. It's just, there's no different. But yeah, they didn't particularly like me, you know, defecting and moving away. And some of the stuff was pretty personal at that time. So yeah, like coming in and saying, oh, I wonder, let it go. Let's not worry about it now. And here's a couple of beers. Yeah, it didn't really sit that well with me.
We got a couple of beers in the fridge for later because we got some stuff we want to say.
That's right.
Have a beer. Drink some alcohol.
So it didn't sit. Strength lager.
Yeah. So it didn't sit that well with me at that time. But in the end, over time, after. We moved on, we played against each other and still had it. It took me a few years to really get over it because it hit me really hard. But after that, Stuart Law came in, was our batting coach with the Australian team for a while, which was great to be able to reconnect with him. And I always had the utmost respect for him as a cricketer. He was a beautiful batsman to be able to watch. He came through at the time of Australian cricket when, you know, there's so much depth in the batting. So I always had the utmost respect for him. But at that time, for those few years in particular, it hit me hard because, he wasn't really that happy with me moving away. But I wouldn't have had it any other way. It sort of tested out where I was at as well because, it was a bit of a baptism of fire. They went pretty hard.
Mm. I think it's such a curious and a compelling article because it's an insight into the way a lot of blokes behaved or thought at that period. Mm. And we're always fascinated by it in world cricket because Australia was so good at the time. And I think there's been this thing in cricket where that sort of behavior was responsible for our success, being that tough or that much of a, you know, the word I'm thinking of there that destroys the YouTube algorithm is the prerequisite for success. We're sort of learning it's not quite like that. And I guess it's a long way of me saying, do you think this was Stuart Law's way of saying, I love you, Shane?
Or I miss you.
I miss you.
Come back.
Possibly in his own sort of way. But that was like playing grade cricket even before that. It was tough. There were guys who'd come back and even guys who weren't playing first-class cricket. They would hop into you big time. And even first-class cricket, it wasn't just Queensland. There were other states where they were testing out the young blokes in particular, which meant that you had to, it was one or the other, either toughened up and sort of knew how to absorb it and not let it affect your game, or you'd flounder and you'd move on to something else. Mm-hmm. So there are some really great things about that because it did mean you had to build this tough exterior. So nowadays that's certainly not really out there. You know, umpires get more involved and there's not as much of that around. So yeah, it's people probably don't have as tough an exterior because you just had to build that. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, coming up in that environment, then you'd struggle. But that was, I said, I wouldn't have had any other way because then when you got into playing international cricket, even if it wasn't on the field sort of sledging or opposition testing you out, it was from the public or the media that you had to try and absorb and build that sort of resilience as well. So if it wasn't on the field, you had to try and build it off it anyway.
Mm-hmm. When you come into the Australian setup, I was just looking at your debut against Pakistan. That was at the SCG, wasn't it? And the team is the team that you come into.
Crazy,
it's Langer, Hayden, Ponting, Martin, Clark, Gilchrist, Warne, Gillespie, McGrath and Watson. I mean, what's that environment like? Take it as read that Ponting's the nicest guy in the room and he looks after you because everyone says that. But does anyone else even look at you or introduce themselves, look over your shoulder, what's going on?
All those guys are incredibly good to me. Hmm. From even my first tour that I went on in 2002 to South Africa, they all opened up their arms and sort of welcomed me into the group. And they didn't have to. Very much in an old school way, that wouldn't have happened. By the stories that I've heard for the guys playing sort of earlier, not just in Australia, but domestic cricket as well, that it was like you had to pay your dues and you just had to cop the brunt of everyone sort of hopping into you until you sort of, you showed what you've got, really. Yeah. But those guys certainly weren't that way at all. Ricky Ponting, from the time that I first met him when I was playing for Tasmania, he just was so good to me.
Yeah.
So, would take me out for coffee and just would be there to be able to sort of bounce and just talk about cricket and life and all that sort of thing. And I can go through just about all of them were the same. Like, and that's why I feel so fortunate of to have gone through Australian cricket at that time, where all those guys just were so kind to me.
Yeah.
They wanted to help me be the best cricketer I could be and be the best person I could be. Mm. You'd go through that list, and everyone in their own way really was so good to me. Mm. On and off the field, they had my back. They wanted to help me grow as a cricketer, and that's why I felt like when those guys retired, it was my turn to be able to then step up and then also pass on that knowledge that they'd given me throughout my career. And that's also part of why, you know, I've also moved on to setting up T20 Stars, because of continuing to try and funnel that information through. Because I was so fortunate to come through at a time where some of the greatest cricketers ever played, not just in Australia but around the world.
Yeah.
And I was engaged into that environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, you know, surely not everyone was just perfectly nice to you coming to the side, but I understand. like it must have been unbelievable coming into the side in 2002. Like, so we talked to Shane Lee a few months ago. I understand he's a mate of yours. One of the first things that happened when he came into the Aussie side was that Steve Waugh told him that Shane Warne would try and take him under his wing. And Shane Warne did do that with Shane Lee and said, oh, we're going to be the Shane show, right? And Waugh advised against Lee doing that. And then 6 years after that, you come into the team. I suppose you see where I'm going with this. Like, you know, your name is also Shane. did Warne, you know, try and create the Shane show with you, Mark II? And what's it like touring with Shane Warne?
It was more the SW sort of show.
Yeah. Right. But I can understand, you know, I mean, you're a young buck.
Yeah.
Blonde hair, chest, pipes, wheels, hits a big ball. Warne's been inside for a while. He's bored. Mm. He gets another Shane to come in. I mean, you would have been a prime target for him, circa.
See, prime target. See, I wouldn't see it in that way at all, to be honest, because it wasn't just Warney who sort of was took me under his wing. I said it was Ricky Ponting, as also Brett Lee, and Shane Warne was another one of those as well. And for me, Warney was throughout my whole career was incredibly good to me, and on the field and off the field. Off the field, not so much in sort of some of the things that he sort of was his thing. I'd sort of stay away from that part. Okay. But the other things
can we
are
talk about it though?
Yeah,
that's fine.
But you saw it.
Yeah.
So that's that side of things. I sort of just that wasn't our sort of mutual connection. It was more so other things. But he was so incredibly good to me. Like the opportunities that I've got that I had throughout my career, him helping me grow and develop as a cricketer, and then the opportunities that he gave me and the belief that he had in and around the IPL with Rajasthan Royals, like he had a massive influence and impact on my career as a cricketer. And if it wasn't for two people in particular, if it wasn't for Ricky Ponting with his mentoring and just looking after me like he did and support and belief that he had, and also Shane Warne with his belief and support that he gave me, I wouldn't have had the career that I did.
Mm. You actually roomed with Ricky Ponting when you were with Tassie, I think. Yeah. There's a great interview you did with Howie a few years ago. It's worth listening to. And you said you didn't sleep a wink. Mm. You were just looking at him.
Not looking at him, but it was dark.
Ah, you said that. I don't know how he asked you, like, did you want to give him a cuddle or something? And you denied that. But, like, what are you thinking while you're just looking at him while I was asleep? You know?
I wouldn't say I was looking at him.
He was staring.
For me, that was a super special moment. Ricky Ponting was my ultimate idol for probably from the time he burst onto the scene in 94-95 in that Sri Lanka test. Just how he played the game. So I absolutely idolised him. So then Greg Shepherd, who got me down, who was a coach of Tassie at the time, who got me down to Tasmania, he, on this pre-season tour in Adelaide, he knew how much I idolised Ricky. So he roomed us together. And I remember walking into the room, Ricky had already arrived, and sitting at the just a little table and chairs in the room, and it was just like my heart sank, or my stomach sank. I was like, I can't believe that I'm actually one room with Ricky Ponting, that I'm actually meeting Ricky Ponting. And then again, as he did, took me out for coffee. And then that first night, I was just that amped about, I can't believe that I'm in the same room as Ricky Ponting, as my idol. So I didn't, Yeah, I didn't really sleep a wink. I wasn't staring at him.
It was more so I sort of throw it in and see if he took it or left it, you know. Yeah, you went over to him.
Stroking his face, saying, Ricky, Ricky.
Why'd you do that?
Yeah. But that was just a real, again, another really special moment that I just couldn't believe. I had to pinch myself to think that I was having these opportunities that, you know, from a growing up in Ipswich, I just dreamed of having opportunities to be able to play with, meet people like, you know, like Ricky Ponty was my idol, was a something that I didn't sleep.
After the 2005 Ashes was such a seminal moment for probably Test cricket in everywhere, not just England and Australia. But do you feel like that after what Flintoff did to Australia, that series, that Australia then suddenly were like, well, we need to find a 2005 Flintoff again? And then you were sort of the first cab off the rank in that regard. Did you feel like that at the beginning of your Test career?
Yeah, well, even before that Ashes series that Freddie just, you know, just obliterated the Aussies, they were always looking for, Australian cricket were always looking for a fast bowling all-rounder.
Right.
You know, in one day cricket is a starting point. Like you talk about Shane Lee and Ian Harvey and Andrew Simons as that sort of middle order fast bowling all-rounder. They were trying to find someone, and I was right place, right time with what I was doing, especially from a bowling point of view with the pace that I was bowling. It was just an opportunity for them to be able to just invest some time into me, hoping that it would work. The investment would work over a couple of years. So that was, you know, when it started in 2002, really, when I first got picked. And then, yeah, the 2005 Ashes with Freddie doing what he did, that was really, you know, put the microscope then on me being the one that had the time invested in me through those, you know, 3 years, really. And I also naively sort of put my hand up at that time as well, that, you know, that's what I want to do, and vocally put it out there in the media and that as well. So that just, you know, really turned up the dial on the pressure that I put on myself.
Yeah,
and I was still only young at that time. I was 24. So, but I'm the one who, you know, who turned up that dial of the scrutiny that was sort of around, wanting to do that, wanting to be that for Australian cricket. Believed deep down that I could contribute at some stage like that. At some stage, not as a 24-year-old.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, and that was where that was sort of my way of turning the heat up. And then, you know, the injuries that I had through that period of time, and it just, you know, annoyed a lot of people because I was injured and then I wasn't living up to what people expected from me as well. But through that whole thing, and this is why I'll keep going back to the team and to Ricky Ponting as a starting point, their belief never wavered, their patience never wavered, which could have, because they were spending a lot of time and investment and emotional sort of energy investing in me as well, because they had to absorb the stuff that was being flung their way to protect me while I was sort of working through that, my injury issues and my performance issues in a way. But then, like anything, if you stick at it long enough, and, you know, I was so determined to be the best cricketer I could be, I certainly never took my foot off the gas in any way. Even if I was injured, I was working on my batting, I was working on various aspects of my batting. So then, if and when I got an opportunity, at some stage, I was ready to be able to try and take it.
That's what I was going to ask you, because, like, I know you've spoken in the past about, you know, the sort of style of training you were doing leading up to getting injured, a lot of weights training. And then, because you're such a finely tuned athlete, or actually just if you do a sort of bodybuilding style training, resistance training, and then go into bowling, those two things just do not align. Then you sort of break down.
Yeah.
And then I understand you moved away from, you stopped drinking, and then you started getting into meditation, you're reading Deepak Chopra, you're doing yoga. What's it like to be a bit of a trailblazer in that respect in the Australian setup, which then leads into, like, sort of the Clark
earthing
Lehman,
yoga
alpha era, and then leads into, like, the Bancroft earthing JL era, like that, you know, like, was it quite a hard departure to move away from that style of training into, like, more of a, I don't know, central earthing sort of movement?
It wasn't hard, because I was desperate.
Yeah.
I was desperate. Like, I wanted to you know, achieve my dreams of one of playing well for Australia. Once I got that opportunity to be able to be in and around the Australian team, then I wanted to be able to live up to what I believed I could achieve on the field, to be able to help my team, to be able to contribute how I really felt I could. So with those injuries that I had, like, in the end, everything that I did from a training point of view was all around trying to be the best cricketer I could be. Like, you know, at that, through my early sort of 20s and that, I was told that if you get bigger and stronger, they're not going to bowl faster. So that's what I wanted. I wanted to be Brett Lee. I wanted to bowl as fast as I possibly could. So which meant that I got bigger and stronger. But then, like, I look back at it, and I suppose the theory around it doesn't really stack up, because you don't see Arnold Schwarzenegger bowling 190 k's an hour.
Isn't it? Like that theory existed that if you're muscularly strong, you'll bowl fast.
That's right.
Jeff Thompson was probably the fastest ever, maybe, and he was not.
Yep.
You know, he was doing beach weights.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, and surfing. Yeah. But that's what I suppose I got caught up with, because that's where it was the information that was coming my way at that time. And again, I was just obsessed with pushing the limit of how good I could be.
Yeah.
And one side of it was positive, because I became bigger and stronger. So it meant that, especially from a batting point of view, I was physically much more mature than my age. You know, that's why I was able to probably compete with guys who were a fair bit older than me, because physically I was stronger. But then on the flip side of that, it meant that I'd push my body to the limit too far, and I was getting injuries. And then it moved to... finding this guy, a guy who was a guy I'd been working with the Brisbane Lions at the time, a guy called Viktor Popov, who was sort of like a guru physio.
Okay.
Who'd worked on the Tour de France and athlete, like so many different, and swimmers and so many different sort of athletes. And he was one who really broke me down from a body point of view and as an athletic sort of point of view. Yeah. That was 2007, after the 2007 World Cup. And in the end, because I was so desperate, it got to a stage where I was like, well, the help that I'm getting is not what I need to be able to stay fit.
Yeah.
So in the end, I invested in having him with me full time.
Wow, okay. Mm.
So, and that didn't sit well within Australian cricket.
Yeah.
Because it's like, well, I'm not getting what I need to be able to try and stay on the field. So you know what? This is my last go. I'm going to invest in myself and see how that goes.
Mm.
And it was a family decision. Well, it was a family decision in a way with Lee, just saying, look, I need to give this one more crack.
Yeah.
Like then, if it doesn't work, then I'll have to probably stop bowling and I'll be a batsman and sort of go back into the sort of pile a little bit from a batting perspective. But I need to give it a crack. And then from having Viktor on tour really helping me continue, it was a 12 to 18 month sort of like process to build up my resilience and just retrain my body in a way. And having him there sort of every step of the way, physically to be able to look after me, but mentally as well, just working through those challenges that I had.
Yeah.
Then I had 2 years of no injuries.
Yeah.
I had 2 years, like that was 2009, once I got the opportunity. I opened the batting in Test cricket. Those 2 years were two of the best years I had in international cricket, and I didn't have an injury. Yeah. So, but to be able to sort of take your back up against the system, it didn't sit that well with a number of people.
Like? You got Popov on tour with you.
Staying at a different hotel because it wasn't allowed.
And the Australian team doctor is there and the physio in there, and you're like, I'm seeing Viktor over here.
Yeah. You're a Test player of the year around that time as well.
After that.
After
that. So, but it was like, for me, I was desperate in a way because it wasn't working.
Yeah.
I knew how hard I worked on my skill, that it was to a point where I knew I could contribute and at the highest level, but my body was letting me down. So I was desperate, and I was willing to have that one last crack at seeing how good I could be. And that was, in the end, from an investment point of view into myself, is the best investment I've ever
good
made.
ROI, Did you stop? Did you stop? Is that when you stopped drinking as well?
Yep.
Are you still off alcohol? Are you still drinking anymore? The odd grade game.
Yeah.
A couple of beers after the game. Yeah. But that was the, as I said, I was desperate.
Yeah.
Like I've always enjoyed having, some beers and enjoy my wine and that sort of thing with my mates. But at that, again, I was desperate. I was willing to do anything. And that's where, I tapped into meditation. I tapped into yoga. I was doing everything I could to be able to just give myself the best chance to be able to, see how good my skill could take me.
Yeah.
This is so fascinating, Shane, because you're often doing things in cricket that kind of contrast with the prevailing culture of cricket at the time. I mean, even just attempting to be an all-rounder, when specialists are kind of all we know to understand here. And I have a question for you about all-rounders in Australia and the nation's expectations of them, right? You sort of laugh cynically as I say it. Like, the thing that gets me about you is, you perform just about every discipline in cricket across every format, competing against worldies who are specialists in the international worldies. You know, how you even divide your time up to compete, to do that, and then to be able to do it. You batted in the middle order in Test cricket, and then you could open the batting and succeed in England opening the batting. You could take fourfers or fivers, you could bowl 140s, and you reformed yourself to be able to be a skillful, slower bowler. You know, has the, and you've done it across all three formats, you know, like, has the country, and then your stats, sorry, your stats at Test level compared to Flintoff, you average more with him with the bat, about the same with the ball, you play a few more matches, and a few more wickets. Stokes is the same. You know, has Australia been fair in assessing your output? Do we need to rethink our understanding of all-rounders in Australia? You know, were you an unfortunate lightning rod for our greed? Because I feel like all anybody wanted out of you was just, oh, make sure he averages 45, scores heaps of hundreds every time he bats and takes fifers. And it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of what you were trying to execute.
Look, it's very kind what you say there, but I don't think the expectations were, in a way, what I put on myself as well, to be totally honest. Like, I wanted to be the best cricketer that I possibly could be. So I wanted to be the best batsman, the best test batsman that I could be. And same from a bowling point of view, I wanted to be the best fast bowler that I possibly could be. So, and then when I'd sort of marry myself up to the greats in each discipline, it would be, well, I want to be able to average 50 in test cricket. I want to average under like mid-20s with the ball. But as you sort of get on, go through your career, you sort of have to like reassess those certain things. But in the end, all I tried to do was just to be the best that I could in every aspect of my game. And that was what I always loved. I loved the thrill of being an all-rounder. Always did. That's why I, going through the injuries that I did, I was happy to continue to absorb it because I just loved the thought of being able to try and make a difference with the ball, trying to make a difference with the bat as well. So look, in the end, I suppose in and around now retiring in that as well and seeing, you know, the expectations that are on, you know, the young all-rounders coming through, and it's not easy, as what you said there, you got to divide your time to be able to try and be, you have to be a specialist in batting and bowling to be able to make it in, to be able to feel like you can make it in the Australian team, for example, as both, you know, from your batting and bowling alone. But that was, I suppose, that's the expectation that's there. There's not that many people who come through because it is challenging, more so around just the time that you spend at training and all the different sort of things that you have to sacrifice compared to, like I have in the last couple of years of just batting in T20 cricket. Your times at training is you bat and you train with your batting and then you do some catching and that's it. So your time's a lot, you know, a lot less that you have to spend training. But that's a thing that I always absolutely love. But yeah, in and around the how people sort of assessed what I did, like that's up to them to do. And I don't think it was unfair in a way. It's what it is. I just tried to be the best cricketer I could be, and that's people's assumptions of what it is.
It's kind of like you know, I know you say, well, I should have, you know, I wanted to average 50 with the bat and mid-20s with the ball or whatever, but you've attempted a degree of difficulty with your dive, you know, at the Olympics. It's like necessarily like needing a higher bar, you know, to get a good mark. I mean, even the HSC, if you do 4-unit maths, you get 30. It's still, you know, 95 or something like that. Like, you know, so are you satisfied with where you got to in international cricket, you know, and the numbers that you put up, or do you go to bed at night thinking I should have averaged 50 and bowled at mid-25s?
I know that whatever I achieved, I did the best that I possibly could with what I had, as in whether it's the skill that I had, the information that I had. The one thing that I look back on now, and if I had a better education on the mental skills side of things, I think that would have meant, especially from a test cricket point of view, that I would have been able to achieve more consistently, especially from a batting point of view. Bowling-wise, my body sort of meant that I had a few more limitations, how much I bowled and how much I could sort of push the limit of being a wicket taker in a way. But from a batting point of view, the mental skill side of things, I just didn't have a mental skill sort of understanding and routine enough to be able to concentrate for longer periods of time. I was very good at putting so much pressure on myself to score runs and perform that I was great at burning my mind out, burning my brain out. So I'd get to 30s, 40s, 50s quite often, and then I'd just make a mistake, which is I always then went back to a technique. It's my technique. I'm getting out LB, I'm getting out caught behind, whatever it was. And I'd only look at my technique. I didn't actually really dig into, well, where was my mind at? How was my concentration in the lead up to it? What was going through my mind as the ball was bowled? I just didn't tap into that because that's not how I was coached in a way, and that's not how I was sort of the information that I had at that time as well. Mm. So that would be my only thing that if I had my time again, that would have had more of an impact from a technical point of view and physical point of view. I pushed the limits of how good I could be. Mm. And that's all I ever tried to do.
You're pretty good.
Mm. Yeah, pretty good as well. I mean, it's a longer question, I suppose, but I'm looking at the awards that you won. Test player of the year 2011, ODI player of the year 10, 11, 12, AB medalist 10, 11, T20 player of the year 12, 13, 17, held number one spot as the best T20 player for 150 weeks, including a record 120 weeks, won the World Cup, Ashes, by the way, you won the IPL.
Footnotes.
And then it's to some, you know, I'm sure you've seen the memes, it's like, oh, you love to review though, what I did, you know, and it's like, and I think it was at a live show. Now, we spoke to Chris Rogers about an incident that I think it was 2011, maybe in the England, maybe, I can't remember.
2013.
Yeah, Lord,
I remember it. He did this story very well.
And so I bastardized it, but he said, before the game, you had said, I don't care what happens, I'm never using the review system again. I'm just not doing it.
Yeah. I'm just not good at it, so I'm not doing it.
Not good at it. And so you get hit in front, you think it's out, you're walking off, and Bucky stops you. He says, mate, I swear to God, that is missing. You have to review. Please, I'll do anything. Inside that. Pleaded review it. Review, I'm telling you, it's missing. Yeah. Hitting all three and you're walking off. Do you remember that incident? Yep. Obviously, yes. Yep. Have you spoken to him since?
Yeah, of course. Bucky, I love Bucky. He's one of the most enjoyable teammates I ever played with. Absolutely. Yeah. And in the end, that sort of stuff, that's a one thing that, if I had my time again, I'd have read the room more. Hmm. As in, I would have, and not within the team, because that wasn't really, that wasn't mentioned, but more so read the room more within sort of the media and the, and social media and that sort of thing, to see what was really being said. Hmm. Because in the end, I was just going by, I grew up that if the umpire gives you out, you're out.
Yeah.
So then it sort of came into, you can actually question. You can question it now.
Yeah.
So, and whatever year that sort of came into, I was a long way into you're out to then going, maybe that might not be out.
Let's have a look.
And then the other thing that I didn't do was really sort of understand and dig into the probability of if the umpire gives you out or not out, what the chances are of them overturning. I didn't, that didn't compute. Mm. But again, if I should have read the room more around what was being said, to then just go, you know what, let's just go back to how it was. Mm. If it's out, if the umpire gives it out, unless I've smashed one and hacked it onto my pad, or I've been given out, caught behind, you know you've missed it by a mile. Mm. Then yes, of course. But outside of that, it would have just been back to what it was. But again, I didn't read the room for a period of time in and around an Ashes series. It's got a little bit of profile around it, and that continues to live with me. But again, I did the best of what I could with the information I had. But again, if I had my time again, I just would have read what was going, what was being said, just to then go, you know what, I don't need to even engage with that. I'll just go back to how it was beforehand. When you're out, and you move on.
It's funny, isn't it? Because it was at the beginning of DRS when that was all kicking off. And obviously, since then, Australia's had no problems using the
system.
So, yeah.
I figured that
out real quick, didn't we?
If you follow soccer or football, but the former president of Barcelona just got arrested yesterday for paying people to shit post about Lionel Messi online on the internet. Right. And personally, to see the same for people who do the same about review it, with you. So I'd see them arrested. It's the most tired trope in cricket, literally a sign that someone doesn't understand cricket.
Yeah, but I stepped into that.
I think batsmen are in a state of almost criminal irrationality when they're hit on the pad or nicking. Everyone who's ever played cricket in the backyard or whatever doesn't think they're out. You know, if you give batters the opportunity to say, especially early on in DRS, I think it's quite understandable. So I guess my question is, what is your relationship to internet shitposters?
Well, then that's why I never read anything. I never really read the media. I certainly didn't engage in social media at all, really. I was probably on it. Smart, yeah. yeah, but And it's only been the last probably year, really, since I've sort of launched T20 Stars, when I've really started to, you know, connect with the, you know, the people who...
What have you learned about people, the internet?
The majority of people are actually really nice.
Yeah.
And really supportive. Yeah. And that's what I have learned. Yeah, there's always going to be a few people out there who don't particularly like what you do, and that's and that's absolutely fine. But again, when I was, especially when I was playing in the thick of it, I couldn't absorb abuse. There's already enough sort of scrutiny on on me and what I was, you know, what me and the team with what we're doing anyway. So I couldn't absorb any more. Whereas now, I've, you know, I can sort of step away from, but I still don't engage. When I was playing a tournament, I did not go like dig into like notifications or find out what people were commenting about. I just, again, I stayed away from that, because it's just there's a few people who, again, they don't particularly, might not like you for whatever reason, and they're happy to sort of have a go. And you don't need that sort of floating around your mind. So I just sort of stayed away from it. Whereas now, again, social media in particular is such a powerful tool. If you can, you know, harness it in the right way, it's a way to be able to engage with people, the people that you normally wouldn't, for example. You just got to, you know, trying to find the best ways to be able to make the most of that, you know, incredibly powerful platform.
Virat Kohli just went past 100 million followers on Instagram. You got 1.8. I know like people focus too much on the number of followers. I don't think they focus enough on who they're following. He only follows 198, of which you're one. So where does that rank, you know, in terms of your career highlights?
With Virat? What do you mean with Virat following
Virat follows you. Yeah,
look, so. One of my career highlights is actually playing with Virat at RCB.
Yeah,
that was like a...
Good player?
Far out. Yeah, that was an amazing experience. It really was. It was an amazing experience for two reasons. Virat, for sure, just to be able to understand what sort of makes him tick on and off the field. And just the great layers of a person that he's got as well. It's not just cricket and that's it. He's a very interesting person. He's very interested in other people as well. But then AB de Villiers at RCB as well. You have to turn the TV on when he's playing, when he's batting. Yeah. So to be able to play with him and get to know him off the field as well, as instead of just sort of battling in a way a little bit on the international scene. So those two things were the highlight. But yeah, Virat, it's nice. Yeah, that's nice. But just to be able to actually play with him, get to know him off the field, that's more of a highlight than whether he follows me or not.
Now, we understand that Virat's big into conspiracy theories.
You're right.
Do you know about this?
No.
It's just literally secondhand hearsay from one person. Let's track this out on YouTube, see what happens.
Exactly. Drop a comment below, like conspiracy theories. I feel like in Australia, we don't really appreciate how much you're idolised in India. Would you say you're more famous in India or Australia?
Is that a serious question? Yeah. Oh, India, easily.
More famous in India, because I mean, you play
more well-known.
Well-known. Yeah. Not famous, just well-known.
I don't like that word.
That's a synonym.
You type in famous.
That word doesn't sit with me that well, but well-known,
known in the public eye.
Yeah.
You play for, Rajasthan, RCB, obviously, and then Chennai Super Kings. I mean, which one of those was the sort of pinnacle? Which one did you enjoy the most? You won it with Super Kings, didn't you?
Rajasthan for me was the such a amazing launch pad for me, like a relaunch, really, in a way. 2008, after having injuries on and off for like 2 or 3 years, I was on the scrap heap really of Australian cricket because of the injuries that I'd had, and that was an opportunity to be able to play an international quality tournament without having to play for Australia, and that was a time where it was a perfect storm. It would have been the time that I'd spent like a year working with Viktor Popov. I'd been able to work on developing especially my power hitting over the previous sort of 2 or 3 years because of where I was batting in the one-day team for Australia, number 7. So it was a perfect storm, having Warnie sort of leading me and knowing how to sort of like direct me and challenge me in certain ways. And that was really where things took off for me as an international cricketer and the belief that I could actually do something against... win games against some of the best players in the world. And that was also where things really launched into into India as well, being playing for a local team, then also playing well, being a bit of an unknown it's probably an Indian cricket in a way.
Yeah, sure.
And then things just from a popularity point of view, things yeah. really exploded, and then yeah. it sort of continued to sort of grow. But so Rajasthan was an amazing experience. Like mm. the whole IPL always has been, but mm. especially the first sort of 3 or 4 years, it was just mm. like everyone who was there was like pinching themselves to think, can you believe we're playing
yeah.
like a tournament of this caliber? The amount that we potentially that we are getting paid mm. to be able to do what we love doing mm. in a like a world class competition. It's also growing our popularity in the biggest cricket market as well. Like just all these things, and then it. So that were the first sort of 3 or 4 years, and then it sort of turned into more. There's like it's sheep stations, like we have to win, yeah, like all that sort yeah. of stuff. So it shifted real to yeah. real really professionalism, mm. and that mm. sort of novelty sort of wore off
yeah,
in
yeah.
a way. So RCB was a great experience after that because of, you know, playing with the caliber of people that I did. It was there, it was run by Diageo, which is sort of a Johnny Walker company. So it was more corporately sort of run, which is different. It's just not that real emotional sort of connection that you have by owners who actually they're putting their real heart and soul into it.
Yeah.
And then CSK was an incredible experience to be able to be in a team that was aging, mm-hmm. with because of the experience that we had. MS Dhoni being led by him, yeah. being coached by Stephen Fleming, who's yeah. Is the best coach that I've really? Worked with. Oh yeah,
yeah.
Man management skills, understanding of individuals. A team environment, but then also his cricket knowledge
mm.
and just he's the ultimate, like I yeah. think, and then his connection that he had with MS Dhoni. So that was a super cool experience as well.
When you come into the IPL and it's like the names that you're playing with, mm. I mean you must have had run-ins with these guys in international cricket. Yeah. Like, for instance, you played with Harbhajan, didn't you, at Chennai,
yep.
who obviously had a bit of a tetchy relationship with Australia over the mm. years, but then you sort of meet these guys. At the beginning, is it sort of like peacocking a little bit? You're trying to suss each other out, who's the alpha in the room, who's played the most test caps or whatever? Is it a bit like that, or is it just like, and you have to apologise for things in the past, or you know, soothe things over or whatever, or is it straight in just like, nah, we're all mates here?
The only really sort of semi-awkward moment was like, so Harbhajan Singh, for example, I always really enjoyed playing against him, and I wasn't playing in that test series when all that stuff went down. So I was sort of semi-unscathed in a way with Harbhajan. But the awkward part was Chris Gayle.
Oh, yeah.
So like he came to the cricket academy when I was at the academy at 19, and I always enjoyed the way he played, and we always got along pretty well sort of when we played against each other. But then things sort of shifted. when we kept playing against each other a lot more.
Yeah.
And then we didn't particularly get along that well at all. Yeah. Had a run in with him.
Missing something there. It was good, then it wasn't. Yeah.
Then it wasn't, was in a Perth test match, really, where he sort of got under my skin. And then I sort of had a go at him. I ended up getting fined because I carried on after getting him out. And then he sort of then fueled the fire in the media saying he expected that behavior and all this sort of stuff anyway. So I just, didn't particularly get along that well at all. And then we were playing in the PSL, like in separate teams, but playing the PSL, and the IPL auction was on.
Mm.
And it came out that I got signed to RCB and he was playing at RCB. And I was like, he was the only one. I'm like, this is going to be awkward.
This bloke, yeah.
It's going to be awkward. We've just like, haven't talked really, and just like butt heads on the field. So then I just had to break the ice. I saw him down at the pool, that next day. And I was like, who would have thought that we're actually going to be playing the same team together after all, And from then on, you know what, it was actually really good. But I definitely had to break the ice because it's awkward.
Yeah.
But outside of that, I've been fortunate that, like even with Virat, we used to have massive battles on the field because he's very like aggressive on the field and very much pushing the limit to win, and that's how I am as well. So we pushed up again, butted heads a lot on the field. Mm. But I always had the utmost respect for him as a cricketer as well. So as soon as I moved into to play RCB, that just shifts and it's not even talked about.
Yeah,
mate. It's so clear that you're like a no stone unturned kind of guy, and you've retired from cricket and you've wasted no time now in just launching what appears to be a massive business. Now, like, I've just had a scoot around the website, so I've Trump said, make America great again.
Where's this going?
You've said you want to make cricket affordable again.
Yeah.
Now, like, we can genuinely get around that. I've looked at the shop. Because there are blokes, you know, and women spending around like $1,200 on a stick just to keep up their cricketing identity or delusions, dreams they should have given up many years ago. but like the game robs you so much emotionally, we shouldn't have our wallets robbed as well at the same time. Yeah. So are you coming to the table today and saying that, okay, while the game might rob you emotionally at any level, that it doesn't have to rob your wallet anymore? I mean, is this the promise of T20 Stars?
It is. Yeah, well, that is the promise. Yeah, absolutely. Because that's part of, and it's incredibly well, I need you as part of my marketing team, because that's brilliantly said. I'm going to use it. I'm going to be using that tomorrow.
Yeah, we talk about the business.
Not the Trump
team,
part, right? but the other part. Because it does, cricket does rob you emotionally. There's so many ups and downs. But but absolutely, that's the core reason why I've started the T20 Stars product cricket range is because it's growing up cricket was affordable. Like my parents certainly weren't, you know, they were in the Air Force. My dad was in the Air Force, so they made the most of what they had. But I felt like I, you know, didn't go without. So mum and dad bought my first senior bat. It was a Schlesinger Bradman edition.
There's a picture on your website.
Nice. It's cool. Yeah. So like, and that bat, I think mum and dad paid probably $300 for the top of the range bat at that stage. Mm. But now the top of the range bat is like, you know, $1,200-$1,300. And I just think if I was growing up now with the, you know, what my parents earned, there's no way that they'd have been able to afford for me to be able to use the top of the range bat, a senior bat, for example. Like then once I started to really like the realization over the last couple of years of how incredibly expensive cricket has got, and I've been part of the problem as well in regards to sponsorship that I, you know, had throughout my career, which I was fortunate enough to have be sponsored by, you know, some of the great brands and getting paid to be able to use their gear. So I was a part of that problem of the expenses that these companies have had to try and recoup. So, you know what I mean? So that's part of the realization.
We should put pressure on players' sponsorships. It's their fault. You know, you guys are driving up the price.
Well, in part it is. And yeah, in the end, what I got paid was the market sort of value.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean, that's what everyone else is getting paid. So, that's what the market sort of was happy to pay. But now that I sort of really dig into the reasons why cricket got expensive, you know, that's one part. That's definitely one part of, you know, the companies trying to recoup their expenses. But the other one that for me is, once I've really read into and researched other business industries and a way to be able to really try and reduce the cost of the same quality product, is by going direct to the consumer. So it's not, it doesn't have to go through the retail. It doesn't have to go through the retail margin, which can be between 30% to 50% of a markup. So so that's the reason why it just made so much sense to me to go directly, you know, directly online, directly to the people who are buying the gear. So it's manufactured out of one of the best manufacturers in India, which all just about all gear, all career gear around the world is manufactured out of a few key manufacturers in India. And, you know, my design and understanding of what I want and what I need for my protection and design that I like, with help from someone we know well, Jared Biviano, the design sort of elements
around.
Shout out,
Jared. Mm. Done a lot of our graphic design and stuff as well.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. So to be able to help put the pieces of my vision of what I wanted as well together from a design point of view. And then it's just trying to then get it out to the world that it's... And also the other thing, because it's online, it's a different sort of buying habit now. Like everyone, especially in around cities, they used to, like it was for me, I grew up in Ipswich, but if you want to go and get a bat, you go to Greg Chappell Cricket Centre in Albion to be able to pick up the bat and try the bats, to be able to try the gear. So it is, people are going to have to, like, I'm finding ways to be able to change that sort of buying habit as well, to make sure that you are getting the best quality products that you possibly can for the best price
bring a
blade. You can. Yes. And I did, absolutely.
Nothing to say. Yeah.
It's a good stick.
It's a good pickup. Yeah. 2.9?
Yeah, 2.9, 2.10. It's a little bit heavier. It's a T20 bat. Yeah. You need a little bit more weight there.
It's a lower sort of middle.
You know the jargon.
Yeah. I just blacked out while I said that. I don't know. I haven't played in 15 years. You know what to do. That's really interesting. I think a lot of, it's a good stick. Like, it's not the fact that it's a lower price doesn't take away from the quality. It might seem too good to be true, but you're just saying you just don't have to go through the retail anymore, right?
Simple, yeah, it's simple as that. And that's the biggest challenge and the pushback that I've had. A little bit of pushback has been, well, so it's cheaper means it's lower quality. It's not great, because we're used to paying high prices. We're being told also that, well, high prices means high quality. But there are ways to be able to make sure that the prices are what they should be, but still making sure everyone gets the best quality products that they possibly can.
I think a lot of people would welcome an affordable cricket bat. I mean,
you must have seen guys in first grade who wanted to look sponsors as well, just buying all the same kit, talking bats, just like, oh, it's two-tone.
Well, that's
two-tone.
Why you've got gloves.
What does that mean? Oh, it's two-tone. Well, that'd be face, mate.
You've lost your right eye. Trying to get the flies out this side. But you've got gloves and pads and stuff as well, right? And your website's actually a whole trove of your knowledge as well. So it's not just come and buy a kit. It's a whole trove of every resource you can call upon from your own knowledge to kit.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of... One part is being able to pass on as much knowledge as I possibly can, and that's part of my podcast that I've put together, Lessons Learned with the Greats, is just trying to tap into that information that I've been fortunate enough to be able to gain throughout my career by spending time and a lot of time with the majority of these guys that I've interviewed. Plus my own sort of information and my own content as well, around what I've learned. So, you know, that's the information and content side of things. But yeah, then it's the products to be able to just make it so. And the more ranges that I'm going to be bringing out, especially leading into next summer, is making sure that I've got from the entry level affordability to then the top of the range affordability as well. So, you know, I have to start somewhere, which is for me a mid-range product to start with, which is the WW, which is my son, Will Watson, for the juniors, and SW for the mid-range for the seniors as well. But the other thing as well is cricket balls. And everything that I know is cricket balls are the thing that it's a huge expense for clubs. It's a massive expense for clubs. And there's no question that, you know, Kookaburra, for example, they've done a lot of great things when it comes to sponsorship for club cricket and sub-district cricket and across the board. But the one thing that we need to sort of hold account is also the prices that clubs are paying for balls as well for the quality. Because it does, it's a huge expense for clubs, and it does, you know, bring them to their knees at times because of the amount of money they have to spend on balls. So, you know, the T20 Stars balls are great quality balls across the various ranges again, and it's the same ethos is around just questioning that you can get great quality products for a more affordable price, depending on what sort of quality they want through that range, because it has to be affordable, because in the end, the people who are buying gear are the people who love the game. They shouldn't be sort of being robbed, to be able to, because they are the ones engaging in the game. They're the ones who are buying their cricket equipment.
It prices them out before they can even start
It can't be that way. We want to make cricket as accessible to as many people as we possibly can. And for me, the primary focus right now is Australia, because... I want to make sure that people who are coming along, who are growing up like I did in Ipswich, that if they want to get into cricket, they can. It's accessible.
You do those pink balls that go straight on Indian wickets as well. Because we need to practice them.
Yeah, not yet. That's on the way.
Yeah. I think there'll be a demand for them as well.
It's called AXARs.
Yeah, AXARs.
I like affordable cricket. I like the idea of affordable cricket. Like, can T20 start paying for like tolls?
Yeah,
is that the next? Yeah, that's right. Yeah, first round on the bar.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's all about giving back, so we're trying to find different ways to be able to give back.
I mean, you know, it has been a little bit of a love-in, but I think you've been really generous with a lot of the questions we've asked as well. And I know in some of my research, I've seen, you know, your dad's a great lover of the game, done the scorecards and stuff like that, and you can kind of see, I think that. And it is rare with the people that we speak to, but you obviously have a certain custodianship of cricket, which is really refreshing. You know, you're obviously running a business, but you're at the ACA as well, and you are truly giving back. So, and you've given back by even coming to do our thing as well. So we really appreciate it. And so wishing you well in the rest of your business. We've got to go because your car's in a clear way in 5 minutes. So, you know, that's cricket. Cheers, Watto, for coming on.
No, my pleasure. Like, thanks so much for having me. You've been very kind. Mm. And you're right. Like, my dad's the one who sort of, you know, passed down that love of the game of cricket. And now I feel it's my duty as well to be able to continue to grow the game and make it so it's a game that people who've got the passion for cricket then have the opportunity to be able to make the most of that passion in whichever that direction they go, whether it's actually as a cricketer themselves or whether it's in administration or whatever they want to do. But it's harnessing and growing that love of the game that I've been fortunate to be able to have starting from my dad.
Cheers, Waller.
Thanks. Awesome.